This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Sam Gosling is a psychologist who's interested in how we project our inner selves. He studies personality differences and how we form impressions of others. How does he conduct his research? Well, in part, he snoops. Sam Gosling joins us this afternoon to talk about this kind of snooping, the subject of his book, Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. Gosling says the stuff we surround ourselves with can be deciphered, decoded. It can reveal whether we're extroverted or introverted, friendly or suspicious, conscientious or weak-willed. But care should be taken. One needs to be on the lookout for fake messages, and incorrect conclusions are possible. Listeners, you can join our discussion this afternoon with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Sam Gosling, is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, a post he took in 1999. His work has been covered in a number of media, including the New York Times, NPR, and Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. Gosling is the recipient of the American Psychological Association's Distinguished Scientific Award for Early Career Contribution. Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You is published by Basic Books, and you'll find our guest online at www.samgosling.com. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Sam Gosling, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How are you?
All right, thank you.
Good, good. Well, what led you to your interest in how we project ourselves through the things we surround ourselves with?
Well, I think we're probably all interested in it, frankly. I mean, I think we all have a pretty big interest in figuring out what other people are like. And I think it was in the course of that, that's why I study personality. I'm a personality psychologist. And my advisor had always been frustrated by what most of people in my field do, which is look at questionnaires, what people say they do. And he'd wanted to say, well, let's see what people actually do. But it turns out it's hard to do that. If I wanted to know what you were like, it'd be hard to follow you around all day and find out what you do. And I realized that many of the things we do, especially in places that we occupy persistently, like our offices or our living spaces, have traces to what we do. And so maybe we can find out what people do by looking at their spaces. And of course, once I got into those spaces, I realized there are many more clues other than just this residue of our behavior.
Hmm. So how much can you tell about someone's character and personality from looking at that individual's home or workplace?
Well, you can tell quite a lot about some things, and it depends where you look. Different traits tend to show up in different places. And one of the things about these spaces is that you can also learn about things that are quite hard to find out by other sources, unless you happen to know somebody really well, such as a person's sense of identity, that sense of who they are.
Hmm. How aware are we of how we build or arrange the places we inhabit in order to, as you put it, signal the self?
Mm-hmm. I think some people are more aware of it than others. But I think typically the process is we're sitting around, or we have a picture, whether it's a photograph from our collection or something, or some piece of decor or a lamp or a vase or whatever it is, and we think, I like that. And that's the conscious experience. I like it, or it looks good there. No, I'll put the photos here, not there. And so we arrange our spaces on the basis of what feels right. So what I'm interested in is, why does this feel right? Why do some things feel right? Why does this, picture of Elvis Presley feel right to some people, mm-hmm. but not to other people? And so I think, we're aware of creating a space, but we're not always aware of sort of the psychology underlying it. And that's really the first step to figuring out other people. It's figuring out our own spaces and why we have them as we do.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to the question, have you gained insights into yourself as a result of this work?
Yes, I have. I've started thinking about it in all kinds of ways. And in fact, one of the even after all of my research, I had always been curious about my own refrigerator. Actually, I mean, typically refrigerators aren't very good places to find out about people, but sometimes they are in rare cases. And I'd always been curious because if you saw my office, it's chaos in here. But my refrigerator, it's OCD. There's lines of tonic water and lines of soda and lines of Coke and all these, you know, and it's quite frightening. In fact, people often, when they see it, they take out their cameras and take a picture because it's so unusual. Mm. And I'd always wondered what was going on there. And it wasn't until I met this guy, Chris Travis, who runs an architecture firm, and I was interviewing him as part of the book. And he creates spaces based on very deep psychological interviews with people, extensive deep psychological interviews. And he had remarked to me how notable it is that many people, when they get into a position where they can build their own house or renovate their own house, how often, although they don't realize it, they're trying to recreate a grandparent's home, because the grandparents' homes are often the feeling of their grandparents' homes, because those were often the times when, as a kid, they felt secure and so on like that. And then one day when I was looking at my refrigerator, having been very superior about all these other people who were creating their grandparents' homes, thinking, oh, isn't it you know, interesting how those people are affected, I realized that I had recreated my grandmother's refrigerator. And that was because as a kid, my brother and I, we used to go out playing, and she'd just say, whenever you get thirsty, just come into the drinks cabinet and help yourself to tonic water. And we'd say, how many tonic waters? Oh, as many as you like. And this whole idea that we could have as many tonic waters as we liked, it was just this you know, incomprehensible sense of never-ending abundance. Mm. And I realized it just felt so secure. And then without realizing it, I had unconsciously recreated that in my own house.
Yeah, also you were the boss there in terms of you got to get it for yourself.
That's right, exactly.
And for kids, that's really powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, and the fact that we wouldn't, you know, at home, we'd maybe have a tonic water, but many? I mean, to us, you know, I couldn't imagine anything, you know, luxurious.
Yeah. Yeah, at our house, the soda pop was doled out by the Dixie cup.
Right, exactly, right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have two photos of you in front of me.
Oh, you do?
One is you're standing in front of a messy office. You just said your office was chaos, but this caption underneath you here says this is not your office because your office was deemed too dull for the photograph.
Yeah.
And then there's this photograph of you in your home.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, did Chris Travis have a hand in this space?
Oh, I wish he did. No, I mean, unfortunately, I had my moved into my home before I met Chris Travis. But he really does do very, very interesting spaces. And what's interesting about it with these interviews he gives to his clients is that the people afterwards are kind of reluctant to acknowledge that their psychology had anything to do with the design process. So they'll say, wow, I'll say, how do you like the place that Travis designed? It fits us beautifully. We can't imagine anything better. We wouldn't change it in any way. And, you know, having been through this long, extensive process where their sort of inner connections are brought out and where you go into their relationships and all kinds of things. And so I said, well, how do you think Chris Travis's process played into the design? And they say, oh, it didn't have anything to do with it. That didn't do anything at all. People are really reluctant to acknowledge it. It's very interesting. But he gets these amazing places that, you know, one example is, for example, one of the clients, how he describes his place is, he goes, I like views. I'm a view guy. Well, sure you like views, but why? And Chris Travis says, actually, it's quite a common thing with men, especially men who have sort of become successful, self-made men who like to have views. Because what it's really saying is they like to look out and kind of survey their dominion. Look what I have. Look what I've acquired. Look at my space. And it makes them feel good. No, that's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's you know, the psychological root of this. And what they're doing there is they're saying, look at what I've acquired and all of my things. And often, you know, that's to show, it's a kind of showing off, you know, which is fine. And but it's showing off, you know, often as Travis believes to some you know other people, which are surrogates, often to a father figure to say, look how I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just make one comment about this photo that I have of you in your home, and I really like this space because it looks to me very organic.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's modern,
mm-hmm.
but there's lots of straight lines, but then there's also lots of curves, and there's good colors. I like the blue and green.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you want to say any more about it, how you came to create this space.
I'm embarrassed to say I had an interior designer do it for me.
But you must have signed off on it.
I did. No, oh, not only that, we were. Yeah, I said this is what I want.
Yeah,
I said I want. Yeah, it's kind of sort of a 70s mod. Yeah,
and, yeah.
Exactly. But we've spoke a lot with him about my, you know, the sort of life I led and wanted to lead. And I think, you know, that actually, I think designers are often, in some sense, much more in touch with their clients' needs than architects. I think the relationship between an architect and clients is intrinsically dysfunctional, really, because architects are about, let me create this thing. I am the artist. I'm going to create this thing, and you will be lucky to live in my wonderful creation.
Mm.
You know, whereas the people who live there think, well, we actually don't want that. You know, what we want is somewhere to, somewhere to put the TV and this. You know, they're thinking about our lifestyle. You know, our lifestyle, meeting our needs. And I think, and some architects, of course, are, you know, at least, you know, make some effort to incorporate their needs. But often, it's partially as a result of the way that architecture is taught in the U.S., whereas it's taught much as a sort of a creative, artistic endeavor rather than a sort of a psychological meeting the needs of the client. So I think, you know, this relationship, you know, often breaks down, and such that architects who do really attend to the needs of their clients are often kind of referred somewhat disparagingly as builders. That's a builder, not an architect.
Mm.
You know, and I think it's a real pity, because our spaces are so crucial to us in terms of our both our living, but also the communicative function that spaces serve to others, which is important.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story now about the building that I'm in. It's relatively new, Campbell Hall. Mm. It's a beautiful building. It was interesting. The architects were wonderful fellows,
mm-hmm.
Very nice and intelligent, outgoing
mm-hmm.
guys, liked them very much, but you couldn't touch their work.
Right.
I mean, it was like they had to be out of our space. The job had to be over, and they had to be gone
yeah.
before we could
right.
pull out the stuff that we work with or
right.
you know want to work with that we live with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, and that's absolutely, you know, as Chris Travis points out, he says, you know, sort of most artists, it's like an artist, and he says, you don't tell an artist, well, I'd like a little bit more orange over there on your painting. They think, how dare you, this is my painting, you know. But with a building, that's just not the right analogy. And, you know, so that's why Travis's process is very much focused on figuring out just what do you do in your daily life, and not only things like what do you do, but what are the sorts of things that get in the way of your relationship? What are the sorts of things that help your relationship? He says it's much easier to, you know, redesign your home than redesign your mate. And many of these things, many of the sort of the processes, many of the architectural features contribute to discord in relationships or in family life and so on. So just because we think, okay, I want a big house, but people don't really know what they need. And sometimes that's exactly not what they want.
Yeah, yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Sam Gosling. He's a personality psychologist, and he's the author of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. There's a very nice blurb on the jacket of the book from Mary Roach, and she says, Sam Gosling is an engaging writer, a brilliant psychologist, and a charming individual, and he must never, ever be allowed inside my office. Are people reluctant to invite you to their homes or offices? Are they eager to have you look in on them, or does that just right there tell you something about them?
I would say that typically people are highly ambivalent. I think people really don't want me to go into their spaces, but actually they do want to know how they're seen. And I think it's very important. I think we generally do. When I was having our first study of living spaces, the very first one I did, I had no idea whether anybody would agree to let me have my team go around people's spaces and you know, snoop around and just see what they thought. And people initially were always reluctant, but as soon as they began to think about it, they thought, yeah, I kind of would like to know what people think of me based on my space. And by the end of the study, we had people almost begging to be in our research. We didn't have time to do all the people who wanted to be in the end, because people are curious, and so they should be. It's important to know how you're viewed.
Yeah. Well, it would be very interesting. I was thinking about this myself. You know, I'm looking around the house last night, and I'm thinking, what am I saying here? Mm-hmm. What are we saying? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, when you're in the midst of it, it's kind of hard to decode that on your own.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking one of the ways I might do that is I might take some photos,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, then take a look at them, and that looks different when it's somehow on paper.
Yeah.
And that might be a useful way to do it.
That's one way. I mean, photos are quite hard to interpret of spaces, because it's very hard to get the overall sense of a place and how things fit together, which really affects the feel of a place. And also you don't get things like how the place smells and is it drafty, and those sorts of things. So, I mean, I think you're right. You can get some things. The only reason I say that is that people now, of course, are always, magazines and saying, here's some photos. Will you interpret them? You know, and you kind of can, but it's relatively impoverished. You know, you can't get down on your hands and knees and look at the books and say, okay, what books are they? Are the books actually been read? Have they, which ones are read more than others? Have they been marked? You know, are the corners bent over? You know, all the sorts of details that end up being quite important in figuring out how something is used.
Yeah. Let's talk with some listeners now. First, we go to a listener in Belgium, Illinois. Line 4, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And I'd like to put you a different side of this same story you're talking about. I do a lot of cabinet work and mill work for different peoples, and a lot of times I'll get blueprints from architects, mm-hmm. and say, you know, we'd like to have a price on this item.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll take and look at it, and then you'll go and take your measurements and come back. And if there's something wrong, they don't want to hear about it. You know, wait a minute, you drew it. Your drawing is 2 inches larger than the opening you want to put this in.
Mm-hmm.
No, I can't be wrong.
Right.
Sometimes it's just impossible. You know what I mean? And so that's another side of them, too. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You want to follow up on that?
I don't want to be too disparaging about architects. But talking about blueprints, actually, one of the associations I had was to sort of one thing that really drove home to me how what Travis does is different from conventional architects is when you look at his plans. So I saw some of the plans he had in his office. Whereas most architects would have something which said, you know, kitchen, master bedroom, bathroom, or something like that, his ones were all labeled with the psychological feeling they were meant to evoke. So one person's bedroom says, peace, tranquility, escape. Somebody else's bedroom, right, and instead of just saying bedroom, where you wouldn't be able to distinguish, somebody else has said, you know, excitement, eroticism, intrigue, you know. So he, from the very, very beginning, he's eliciting these associations with different spaces and how those should be evoked. He's not just listing them both bedroom and bedroom. It's really getting at the underlying psychology of these places, which I think is what really makes it so interesting.
Let's go next to Kankakee, a listener on line 1. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I don't know, this might be a little bit far afield, but I'll try to dovetail it in. I was curious, my wife is very creative. She's a dance teacher, and we live in this big house, and we always try to make sure that our living space, our entertaining space, the living room, dining room, whatever, is nice and neat, pristine. But with two kids, don't go in our drawers, don't go in our closets. Don't go in the attic or basement because it looks like a small tornado has gone off in there. And I was just wondering, I've known people who have, like, pristine, well-identified garages. Everything is, I would almost say, dusted. But these people seem to either live alone or have a god-awfully amount of time on their hands. And I don't know anybody with a family with kids that have has everything in order, per se. But I was just wondering, have you found that in your travels? I guess the busier people are socially, whatever, the less time they have for neatness or order. And I was just wondering what it says about somebody who, cleans up, maybe makes things presentable right before they entertain. And I'll go ahead and listen off there. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, I think that brings up actually a whole bunch of different points, so I'm not sure if I can remember to make them all. But one of the things it brings up is that there are many different varieties of cleanness and tidiness. So the listener there was talking about the tidy living space and so on, but the mess in the drawers. And so that's something we look for. There are many different varieties of mess and varieties of tidiness. So is there the cleanness, the tidiness out in the open, but if you look in the drawers and cupboards, it's just chaos inside and everything's clearly been just stuffed in there. Often you'll see two clean desks, but they'll differ by looking at the drawers. Inside one of the drawers, it'll be just as organized and orderly there, all the paper clips and the paper clip holder and the pencil sharp and spare stamps there. You open the other drawer from somebody else's clean desk, and you can see the desk is only clean because they've opened the drawer and just swept everything into it. And, you know, so that's why you, when you're sort of going around these places and looking at them, you really have to look quite deeply beyond these sort of superficial similarities to see how these places are actually used. But to address more directly the question of this, of have I seen people's places who are truly neat, who are busy and family. Yes, I have, and I've actually seen an enormous variety. And one place I was looking at quite recently comes to mind, where I said to the person, I was commenting on how neat and tidy it was, and her response, sort of in contrast to the listener, there was well, you know, with all this, with my family and all these things going on, you have to be tidy, don't you? Right, rather than the current listener saying, with all this stuff and family going on, it's very hard to be tidy. And that's one of the things that I think is so interesting about how spaces reflect what's going on, is it really reflects the way people behave on a day-to-day basis. And that's why these spaces are actually quite hard to fake, because it's quite hard to really create the level of tidiness that a truly tidy person has if you're not that way. Going around people's spaces, and even in our first study, we very, very quickly came to notice the difference between a tidy place, a deeply tidy place, something that's tidy at a structural level where things have their places and things have been thought about and organized and supplies have been bought beforehand and so on, distinguish that sort of deeply tidy place from a tidied place. Because a tidied place, there's only so much you can do, even in a few hours or even a week or so. You have to live the tidy life to have a deeply tidy place.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign. Line 2, hi.
Yeah, hi. This conversation is really interesting, I think. And I wanted to kind of touch a little bit back on the architecture issue a little bit, and also relevant to what you were just talking about. I find in so many people's homes that I'm in that I think it would be interesting if people used architects more, because I find that so many homes, especially newer homes built after about 1960, the space is very uninteresting and not often thought through, both in terms of how it fits into the landscape and also, you know, how the usage of the space is, and just the architectural detail that would make, you know, that lends interest and uniqueness to the home. And so many homes today, especially a lot of the homes around $200,000 to $300,000, you know, they seem like they're just kind of thrown up without any thought to the real soul of the home and what is meant by that. And what amazes me is I think a lot of people don't even think about that. They don't think about how their home really reflects them. And a lot of people's homes kind of look like they pulled it out of Pottery Barn or something, rather than having things in their home that really reflect their travels or their family or their sports or their other interests. And I would like to see, more attention paid to architectural development and building of homes and people, thinking more about their space and how what they surround themselves with in their space. So anyway, that's I don't know if you have any comments on that, but that's what I think. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I personally have a number of reactions. I agree with the listener that, I'm not saying architects are not important. I think architects are important. Obviously, they're important and need to incorporate these concerns of as building an interesting space and building a place that is consistent or fits in well with the surroundings and so on. What I think is sometimes not sufficiently emphasized, though, is really meeting the individual personal needs of the people who are going to live there. And I think that the listener touched on this is that people often don't aren't sufficiently assertive, or they don't even think about, well, maybe that's something I should be doing. And I think it somewhat needs. This is why the sort of the relationship, I think, is a bit messed up with architects and clients often, because it's often like the architect is considered sort of this in a superior professional position. But I think it's worth enabling the clients to speak up and think, getting them to say, yes, this is what I want to think about it. So often we arrive in a sort of standard box, and then we kind of psychologically squeeze ourselves into it by putting up art and objects and arranging the furniture and so on, rather than starting from scratch and saying, okay, this is who I am. Let's build the space around me.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Two questions, quick ones. The first one is, personality can be seen as something that somebody possesses, and it also can be seen in part in any way. That personality is really in the eye of the beholder. That is, if I talk to somebody, then I interpret through his behavior what this person is like, and I project my idea of a personality on that person. And how can this figure into designing a structure? And the second one is related. Take any personality variable, let's say something like internal or external locus of control, and then compare that with authoritarianism versus non-authoritarianism, which all of us have elements of these. Which one of those is going to be figuring into building the structure? Am I making myself clear with this?
It doesn't need to be one or the other. There are many different ways of expressing many of our traits. So, for example, we have many values. Each of us has many values. It doesn't mean we have to choose one value to express. We have many attitudes. We have in a family home, there may be many individuals who have senses of identity that are derived from, say, their ethnicity and their upbringing and their career and so on. And I don't think expressing any one thing is at the exclusion of any other.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, psychologist Sam Gosling. He's a personality psychologist. He is at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. And toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks to that last caller, maybe now we can talk about a couple of figures in the book, a couple of of other, I believe they're both psychologists, Dan McAdams and Arthur Aaron.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Dan McAdams is really interesting, and I think that this, the questions that he has been investigating really point to the value of this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
He asks, what does it really mean to know someone? What do we need to know to get to know someone better? So maybe you would talk with us a little bit about how he goes about exploring these questions and what kind of answers has he come up with?
Yeah, well, I think he's really interesting because what most people in my field study is what we call these traits, like extroversion and so how outgoing is somebody, is these behavioral regularities. And that's all very well to know that. If you're wanting to, say, hire somebody to work, you know, at the office, you want to know if they're reliable and outgoing and have, you know, wide interests. That's all very well. But McAdam says that's not really what you'd want to know if you to really know someone. You'd want to know much more than that to, say, be in a relationship with that person, how that person sees himself. So McAdams has what he calls this idea of a personal myth, this deep sense of who we are. And it's a story about, it's the story we tell about our lives. And he uses, I think, the term myth very, very cleverly. What he means by myth here is not that it's necessarily false, but this deep sense of identity, the truth or falsity, often isn't relevant. So it might be that if you see yourself as the victim, somebody, oh, I'm always getting victimized, you know, I worked the hardest at the office, but I was yet again overlooked for the promotion, or I didn't get the opportunity to go and do this. You know, some people may have that sense of being the victim, and it may not be true. But whether or not it's true is not important. If you to really know that person, you have to know that that is how they see the world. And so McAdam says we have to go way deeper than traits. We have to go down to looking at people's values and attitudes. But ultimately, to really know someone, we need to know this deep sense of identity, their sense of who they are. And that's one of the things that I think shows up in physical spaces.
Mm. And the other person I mentioned, Arthur Aaron, his interest includes what draws us together, what connects us, why do we fall in love with the people we fall in love with?
That's right. So he's you know, mainly he studies a lot of things, but his main field is relationship research, and looking at many romantic relationships and just this idea of people feeling close to each other. So as part of his research, he needed to find, well, can I, for my studies, I can't study real people in real relationships, or I want to decide, well, for experimental purposes, for the purpose of the study, that these people are going to feel close to each other, but this other group of people aren't going to feel close to each other. So what he did was he devised a procedure of making people feel close to each other very, very quickly. And so he gets people to involve in this sort of sharing game, this, where people share these questions, which really help you get at the sorts of questions that would figure into McAdams' sense of identity, who they are. So he gets people to sit in pairs or in groups, And they ask a question. A question, for example, here some of them are, you know, given the choice of anyone in the world, whom would you have as dinner guests, for example. So that's a sort of superficial one. But then they get deeper and deeper. So do you have a secret hunch about how you will die? And what, if anything, is too serious to be joked about? So these sorts of questions, they're really, you know, get at really to the heart of who ones are. And he finds that when people ask each other these questions, they end up, in a very, very short amount of time, actually, feeling much closer to each other.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
This is so interesting. I guess I have a comment more than a question, but it's also a question about cross-cultural understanding, since I detect a non-native accent. My question was between Spain and the United States. In Spain, people would never put a personal picture in the workplace on their desk of their family or of their girlfriend or boyfriend. You just don't see personal pictures in the workplace. But in the United States, it's rather expected. You know, who's your family? Who are the important people in your life? What does that say about our values as a culture and our understanding of what that means?
Yeah, well, I think that the cross-cultural element is very, very interesting. And you do, of course, have big differences across cultures, even within a broader culture. So, for example, at the offices we looked at, the norms for what one displayed varied very much from, say, the advertising offices that we looked at versus the commercial real estate company that we looked at. So the norms of expression and what one says and what's permissible and what isn't vary even in that way. And those differences between places do say something about the culture of those industries, just as they, as the listener suggests, they may between the difference between the U.S. and, say, for example, Spain. But I think one way that I like to think about these things is talking about these general processes that link us to our spaces. So I talk about three processes, what I call identity claims, which are deliberate expressions we make to others. So deliberately putting up, say, a poster of some icon. We put a poster up of Barack Obama to signify our values. And if you have a picture up, people know what that means. That's deliberate ways we signal to others and to ourselves. Mm-hmm. There's also what I call a feeling regulators, which is how we affect the environment to make us feel a certain way. We might play certain music rather than other music. We may put up a photo of a loved pet or something like that. And then there's this one that I hinted at earlier called behavioral residue, which is just the fact that some of our behaviors leave a trace in the world. Like, I have a very messy desk, and it's just messy because that's my behavior is such that once I get something out, I don't put it back again. And so I think you can take those three processes and apply those differently across cultures. Now, of course, how those processes get expressed, whether it's in the U.S. or Spain or elsewhere, would be different. So the actual language used in these different cultures would be different, but the underlying processes, I think, are similar.
Do you agree that Americans, the general rule is to put family or personal pictures in the workplace?
I mean, it varies. I mean, I don't know about Spain. I haven't looked at spaces there, but in many places that is true. In some spaces, that is less the norm. But yes, you know, and what it may reflect, and I don't know because I haven't looked at these Spanish places, you know, is norms about whether it's okay to integrate one's personal and professional lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Okay, thank you. So interesting.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Maybe we should talk about the messy desk, though. Does a messy desk mean messy, muddled thinking? Does it mean an unproductive worker? What does it mean?
It doesn't necessarily mean that. And, of course, when talking about a mess, my desk is incredibly messy. And it sometimes can reflect many things. And this really gets at one of the keys of snooping, is to not to interpret any single clue alone, because any clue could have multiple meanings to it. I see it sort of like a doctor. You go into the doctor and you say, I have a headache. The doctor doesn't immediately say, well, you must have malaria. The doctor immediately says, oh, okay, you have a headache. Let me now ask other questions that will help me narrow down my diagnosis. So if somebody has a messy desk, you might want to look at other things. You might say, well, it's messy, but does it have this deep level of tidiness? Is this somebody who aspires to be tidy? And one way you might see that is, do they have all kinds of unopened and unused office supplies, which signify that they really are hoping to get their act in order for that mythical day when they're actually going to have time to do it? We would never get around to it. So it doesn't necessarily mean that. And the other important thing is, bear in mind, is that sometimes you want people who are more chaotic and disorganized, depending what you want. Like, if I go to my accountant, to visit my accountant, I want that place to be incredibly tidy and organized. I don't want to see papers everywhere there. That would creep me out. Whereas if I went to see, you know, say, an advertising person, if their person was absolutely immaculate, I might be thinking, oh, well, this person isn't really going to be able to push the boundaries in the way that I'd want them to.
Let's take another call. A listener in West Chicago, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I was wondering how you feel psychology enters into the election process. I know we got elections going on, for this year. And I think related to the media. I think a lot of the psychology factor is related to what the media is putting out there. You know, it just seems to me like the media likes to hype things up and twist things around and do half-truths and in order to inflate things and make things worse or not, you know, worse enough. I'm just curious what you thought of, and if there's maybe a psychologist behind a lot of this.
I don't know what you can do with that.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, most of what people do, right, in terms of political attitudes and values are, I mean, those are psychological states. So, I mean, if anything, that is surely what these campaigns are working on. What we have found in our research is that you can often get signals to people's political orientation by their spaces. It's long been known that different political orientations are associated with certain personality traits. I mean, and these aren't, of course, perfect correlations. These are just general tendencies. But in general, research has shown by many people that people towards the conservative end of the poll, they tend to be more concerned with order and predictability, whereas people towards the liberal end of the poll tend to be more associated with a diversity of interests and values. And those things are reflected in people's spaces often. So if you see so conservatives, and again, these are just generalizations, but people who are more conservative tend to have places that are orderly and organized and in combination with things that reflect more concrete traditional interests. They tend to have more flags, especially more American flags. They have more sporting memorabilia in general than liberals, whereas liberals tend to have places that are more on average messier and also reflect a greater diversity of interests, such as in the books and music and art and so on.
Mm. Well, speaking of campaigning and politics, what can you tell us in general about handshakes?
Ah, well, handshakes are interesting. There was all kinds of research done on those. And what's interesting is that some of the expectations about people's handshakes reflect our expectations, and some of them don't. So what's really important to know here is that generally people who have a firm handshake, a firm grip, are perceived broadly to be higher on many positive traits. They're considered to be more outgoing, they're meant to be nicer, they're more responsible, and they have so in generally they're viewed in a broadly positive way. It turns out from research done by William Chaplin, who did very, very extensive studies where he very cunningly got people to shake hands with all kinds of different people so they could make sure that people shook hands consistently across contexts and so on. What he showed that only some of those expectations are right. So in general, he showed that people who have firm handshakes are not necessarily nicer, they're not necessarily more organized, but what they do tend to be is they tend to be more extroverted and they tend to be lower, more emotionally stable too. And in the case of women, and only women, firm handshakers tend to be higher on this trait of openness to experience, which is sort of broad-minded and curious and intellectual.
Yeah. And one last question, another kind of... let's just kind of do a little generalization about clothing.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, so clothing is interesting. Here you can apply many of these processes that I'm talking about, the identity claims, the behavioral residue, and so on. One of the interesting things that we found was looking what the traits that came out was narcissism. So, you know, this idea of the people who are really into themselves, essentially. And in our study, and it wouldn't occur in all contexts, this is a study where people are not, we had people come in to our laboratory and they didn't know what they were coming in for, and that's important. And we found that you could tell the narcissists in females, they tended to wear more makeup, they tend to be more made, and they tended to show more cleavage than the low narcissists, and the males tended to wear more designer clothing and so on. Now, of course, this wouldn't be the case in another context. It wouldn't be the case if you're going to some ball or something where the norms are to be looked at. But in the ordinary everyday process, we notice those differences between those personality types.
Very interesting. There, we have to wrap up. We're out of time. Sam Gosling, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Sam Gosling is a psychologist. He's a personality psychologist. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. His work has been covered in a number of media, including the New York Times, NPR, and in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. He is the author, our guest, Sam Gosling, of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. The publisher is Basic Books.